Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Women comprise a majority of the American workforce today. But still, in 2010, women are taking home 20% less pay than men. It's hard to believe in an age where women can become doctors, lawyers, prominent politicians, and sports stars. But the national wage gap has women across the country making 77 cents to every dollar a man makes. This hour On Point, women, equality, and pay. You can join the conversation. Young workers, seasoned workers, have you noticed a wage gap at your work? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from Beacon, New York, is Jessica Bennett. She's a senior writer for Newsweek magazine, where she covers cultural affairs, social trends, and women's issues. Her piece for Newsweek.com this week was Tracking the Wage Gap, and she blogs at EquityMyth.com. Jessica Bennett, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
And with us from Culver City, California, is Caitlin Flanagan. She's a writer for The Atlantic and author of To Hell With All That, Loving and Loathing Our Inner Housewife. Caitlin Flanagan, thank you for being with us.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
So, as I said, Equal Pay Day was this week, which marks the number of days that women, on average, would have had to work into this year to equal men's salaries last year. The common statistic, even cited by President Obama himself, is that women make 77 cents to every dollar a man makes. In this day and age, what accounts for that wage gap, Jessica?
Well, I think that there's still sexism and there's still discrimination. And, you know, I'm coming from a unique perch in that I'm 28. So I haven't faced many of these issues that my mother faced, that the generations prior faced, to a really overt degree. But the wage gap still exists, and there's a lot of criticism about how we got to this point and how we got to this 77 cents figure, because that figure doesn't account for job choice. But a lot of my research has looked at young women, and the fact of the matter is that from the moment women step into the workforce, they're making less money, and that is with or without children.
So briefly, we'll get into the details of it throughout the hour, but how did they come to this specific statistic of 77 cents to the dollar that a man makes?
Well, it really looks across the board at men and women in all fields working full-time. And so the argument has been, well, women often choose lower-paying fields like nursing or like teaching. And so, you know, it may be a biased point. And we can get into that later, but it's interesting to sort of break down all the nitty-gritty of it.
Tell me how the pay gap has changed over the years, over the last generation.
Well, you know, when the Equal Pay Act was passed in 1963, women made 59 cents on the dollar. So we're much better. We're making 77 cents to the dollar today. But that's still an increase of less than a half penny per year. So I think that the sense is things have gotten much, much better. And for my generation, you know, in many cases, we go into the workforce expecting to be equal. But it's still there. And in the current man session, as people are calling it, where men are losing their jobs in much higher rates than women, I think this is almost more important than ever before, because if you have a family where the female is the primary breadwinner and she's bringing home 20% less bacon, that really hurts American families.
Caitlin Flanagan, how do you see these numbers?
Well, first thing, I think this is a really important subject. I'm so glad Jessica's covering this at Newsweek. I think this is the unfinished work of the women's movement. A lot of times in the women's movement, people will talk about more emotional aspects or more esoteric things. But right now, this difference in the way that we're compensated for our work, this is absolutely where the rubber hits the road. We need to understand it and we need to change it. But the first thing we have to understand is that it's not simple sexism anymore. It certainly was 40 years ago. You weren't supposed to take that job a man had because he had a family to take care of. Employers could legally say that to you if you were a woman. Wouldn't matter if you yourself were maybe a single mom and had children at home. You weren't to take that job. That belonged to a man. But when we look at that number, 77 cents on the dollar, it's no longer simple sexism. The reason for that, we can figure it out intuitively on our own. If a company could hire a woman for 70 cents on the dollar, a man would never get a job. The brutal, efficient fact of capitalism is it always locates the cheapest labor force. That's why we've lost all these manufacturing jobs in this country. It has to do with much deeper things about the way women think about work, the kinds of work they choose, and the way they behave when they're at work. And these are the things we need to change.
So it's nuanced, you're saying, and in some cases it's complicated.
It is. The highest paying jobs, men are clustered in them, and the lowest paying jobs, women are clustered in them. In the highest paid work, the high salaries go to technology and the hard sciences, not to the liberal arts. That's why a lot of us have been so adamant. I'm a former school teacher before I became a writer and a journalist. We were so adamant in getting girls into math and science, and people thought that this was for some sort of intellectual or academic parity. And it wasn't just that. It was because that's where the high-paying jobs are. Now, at the other end of the pay scale, when you get to the unskilled jobs, women will always seek work that's, number one, physically safe and that's indoors, and you lose a lot of money for that. A FedEx driver makes more than a restaurant hostess, but women would rather be restaurant hostesses. A meter reader makes more than a receptionist, but women would rather be receptionists. The way we think about how we want to work and what we want to do is something that's costing us a huge amount of financial worth and equity.
Jessica Bennett, let me drill down on that 77 cents to the dollar statistic because there are economists and critics who say that that number doesn't tell the whole story, as Caitlin was just suggesting, that factors like education and experience also play in here. They say if occupation and industry and unions, for that matter, are factored in, that women, in fact, make 91 cents to the dollar. How do you feel about that number?
Well, I think that we're right to question the 77 cents on the dollar statistic because it's very broad and very overarching, and you can't account for nuance within that. But I also think that the fact of the matter is women, whether they go into teaching or nursing or the sciences or very high-paid positions in business, they still make less. And I have a study here that I'm looking at that looks at women from humanities to biological sciences to engineering to education. And across the board in each of these areas, the average difference between men and women is 20%. So, you know, I'm not exactly sure where the economists questioning this got to 91 cents. But I think the point is that women, whether they have children, whether they don't have children, whether they go into engineering, whether they go into teaching, they're all making less. So you can argue about the specifics, but something is still happening. Some form of sexism is still existing. That's what we're facing.
What about Caitlin Flanagan's point about the types of jobs that women take versus men, that women
right.
tend to cluster in lower-paying fields? The most educated swath of women, for example, gravitate toward teaching and nursing. And men with comparable education become business executives, scientists, doctors, and lawyers, jobs that pay significantly more. Jessica?
Right. I mean, I think this is a problem that many women have been trying to fight and many men have been trying to fight by encouraging young women to enter into the sciences, enter into technology fields. And, you know, I think there's a few issues going on there, one of which is that these fields are often so, so dominated by men that it's hard to know you're going into this and you're going to be the only woman in your classes in college, in your graduate courses, and then in the workplace. And, you know, I wrote about a group of Tufts University students who call themselves the Nerd Girls. And maybe you guys in Boston are familiar with them. But they're basically embracing engineering. And they're part of this program, and they're trying to get young women before they enter college to really get interested in these areas. But I've also looked at some studies related to women in engineering, and a lot of women say that, well, they feel like they need to act like a man or survive like a man to make it in this industry. And so I don't think it allows for having children, and this is something that Caitlin has written about a ton, but it doesn't allow for that. And there's sort of this push-pull between, do I hide all semblance of my femininity to really behave and look like a man, or can I act like a woman? And am I going to be punished for it? So, you know, I think this spans so many issues, but we do need to encourage women to go into higher paying.
Let me ask about that before we go to break here, and we'll touch on it again after. But Caitlin Flanagan, how does motherhood play into this? As someone who's made my own choices around this issue, how does it play as far as the pay gap is concerned?
it's the biggest single force there is, and I don't know how to solve it, and it's quite heartbreaking. But Jessica's right. I mean, I'm a former school teacher. As a former school teacher, I can tell you, a woman and a man doing exactly the same job, he can be making more. Why? She fell out of the labor market for a few years. She made her hard choices. She had to stop working for a couple of years. He stayed on the job. She lost her seniority. She lost one or two or three pay increases. She typically didn't negotiate her starting salary. Women are four times less likely than men, and that really adds up. And that's the thing I do not know how to solve.
And what do the numbers show about how much women are coming back to? Is it significantly less when they return to the workforce?
Oh, absolutely. Just think about there's two factors. Number one are the pay increases you lose over time. So they might be doing the same number of the same kind of job and have the same degrees, but she might have lost three or four pay every year. You got a pay increase in a teaching job. She lost all of those. And there's also an issue that men work more hours at a job in any given week than a woman does because she's always rushed. We're always rushing home. You know, we always feel that burden to get there for whether it's children, elderly parents, caregiving. And every extra hour that you work doesn't always just equal an extra hour of pay. It can equal a whole series of economic rewards because you're becoming, again, more senior and moving towards those promotions that pay more.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the wide gap between men and women when it comes to pay, wages. Jessica Bennett is with us this hour. She's senior writer for Newsweek. And Caitlin Flanagan, also with us. She writes for The Atlantic. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now. With me in the studio is Nancy Kane, a historian and professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School. Her latest book is The Story of American Business. Nancy, welcome back to the program. Nice to have you.
Yeah, pleasure, Jane.
So put this discussion into historical context for us.
So I think it's important to realize that this is just a huge inflection point that we have lived through, beginning in the 1970s and really accelerating into our own moment. And it is social change on a really unprecedented level. You know, Virginia Woolf once talked about a room of one's own, a place where women would have the autonomy to write in her own voice and what that would do to give women a sense of their own power. I mean, we are really looking, if we go back to the late 70s, when women began to pour into the workforce in record numbers, and now in this man's session, when men have lost three-quarters of the 7 million jobs lost since early 2008, we are really looking at a big, big shift in power, in possibility, but mostly in terms of different roles and responsibilities at home and at work. And this is a big, big deal historically.
So the current recession has exacerbated this issue.
Absolutely, made it even bigger. Mm-hmm. And if you go back and you just think about the history of industrialization, women have poured into the workforce in a couple of different big moments. They did in the late 19th century when the secretarial pools and the factory worker pools were forming. They did again during World War II when men went off to fight and women poured into jobs that men had held. They did, and some of that continued into the 1950s, and they did again then in beginning in the 1970s. And each of those moments, it's hard to remember this or see this now, but each of those moments has been followed by major shifts in women's positions socially, again, at home and in their broader public roles. It's no coincidence that women get the right to vote, right, in the teens, right after this first big influx of women working for money. It's no surprise that birth control and the women's liberation movement, you know, really kind of symbolized by the publication of The Feminine Mystique in 1963, come about in the wake of women pouring into wage-earning jobs. Really, the question, I think, for us at some very fundamental level is, you know, what are women going to do with what is in reality, from a historical perspective, a great increase in actual power?
Well, let me take you back to the number, okay, to the statistic, to the wage gap itself, the 77 cents to the dollar. You know, there are those economists who suggest it's 91 cents, that the gap is much smaller. But what's your answer to the question of, you know, this is a nuanced problem, back to Caitlin Flanagan's point, that it's complicated, that the way women think and the choices that we make and the instincts that we have to care for our families, they all play into this. It's all in the pot being stirred up.
No question. So there are pieces that are of that wage gap, and if you count women that have only worked 40 hours a week and take out the 35-hour week, the gap narrows again. So we're still talking about a real gap, though, and that gap has pieces that are explained by these different forms of nuance. There's also a big sexism piece. Power is never granted happily. So if you look at the very top tiers of wage earners in our society, I'm talking about Fortune 500 jobs, women hold very, very few. Men hold 90% of the highest titled jobs in the Fortune 500. And that is not, that's not strictly about the kind of nuance we're talking about. There's a big element of sexism and what does this new world mean on the part of the boys around the table. And there would be in any similar, you know, big shift in possible agency.
Jessica Bennett, what are the industries in which women are actually making similar amounts to men?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. Let's see. I have a chart here. Education, they're very close. Let's see. Public affairs and social services, very close. I mean, I think that how you would typically think of this, that, you know, a female secretary may not make as much as a male secretary, but she's going to make pretty darn close. And in these higher paid, riskier professions like business, like Fortune 500 companies, the gap increases. But on top of that, in these higher paid levels and professions, it's not just that the gap is there, it's that the gap between men and women workers is there. I mean, you know, I've heard a statistic that all but 3% of Fortune 500 CEOs are men. So, and women make up less than a quarter of law firm partners, they make up less than a quarter of politicians. And this is all, as Nancy mentioned, despite the fact that we are excelling to, you know, insane degrees in academia. Women now earn 60% of college degrees. We have caught up with men in the earning of graduate degrees. So we're really excelling in every way imaginable up until the point we enter the workforce.
And yet women who choose the same profession as men, or men who choose traditionally women professions such as nurses, RNs, men in those professions earn more, don't they, for the same
yeah.
job?
And I think that there's a cultural element here too, which is, as I think Caitlin mentioned, women are four times less likely to negotiate a salary. So there's kind of this cultural influence telling us that we need to speak up and demand equality and demand the pay that we deserve. But then when we do, we're afraid we're going to be called shrill or strident or a bitch. And, you know, there was a recent study, I think, out of Harvard that showed that women who do ask for more when negotiating their first salary are less likely to get the job because they're perceived as pushy and less nice. So on the one hand, we're supposed to demand equality, but on the other hand, when we do, we're punished for it. So how,
Caitlin Flanagan, jump in here.
Well, you know, listening to all this, and there's a part of me who's, you know, a school teacher for many years, and the daughter, the very proud daughter of a nurse. My late mother was a nurse. And one of the things that we often talk about, and I certainly do myself, is talking about getting women out of those jobs. But there was such a deep tug in my heart just now listening to all this, a conversation that I'm certainly part of, and saying, but teaching is some of the most important work we will ever do.
Right.
And there's nothing more important than being a nurse. And that women are our society, I think a deeper issue here, we don't really value economically as a society the things that women are so good at and that have built our country. Sometimes I think about the success of America a little bit like the success of a traditional marriage. You know, sometimes there'll be a divorce and the man will say, I want all the money, and the lawyer will rightly say, well, hold on. Maybe your wife didn't work, but she built that home and she watched those children and she created the context for you to earn that money.
Right.
And in our country, we are devaluing women that same way. So that we're saying, your teachers will pay you this, we're nurses, that's not like being a doctor. You're taking time off to care for all those old people, and or, you know, who are in a family, oftentimes the woman's caring for the husband's elderly parents because he doesn't really know how to get involved in that kind of thing. There's something in us that's our spirit and our heart, and I never want to say that we should, as a gender, sort of devalue that and move away from that. It's so important, and it's who we are.
Nancy,
and if I can just...
Go ahead, Jessica.
I was just going to say, you know, typically when you look at the corporate world, it's for so long been male-dominated that corporations tend to value male traits. And a lot of these male traits are things like aggression and risk-taking, while women are often more gentle and we are loyal and we're communicative.
And we do some other what are traditionally conceived of as male things differently. We trade differently. Women bond traders. Women traders in the financial markets trade differently. Guess what? They're a little more conservative. They do their homework a little better. They tend over long studies and lots of different ways of cutting this. They tend to be better traders, if we want to go back to the financial crisis, because of that, with higher returns than men. So I think the issue that both Jessica and Caitlin are talking about is that if we open up and women walk into a breach that has been opening, we want to keep in mind that 100 years ago, Laura Ingalls Wilder would never have conceived of this conversation. So a lot has changed very quickly. But if women continue to walk into the breach, into positions of power in big organizations, including the big boy banks, I think we'll start to see, to Caitlin and Jessica's point, a shifting of values. We already see it in many women-dominated companies.
Here's Jennifer, one of our listeners calling from New Britain, Connecticut. Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for waiting, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I'm just calling because I'm an electrical engineering student at Naugatuck Valley, and there's been a lot of seminars and for women in science and engineering recently, and the consensus is that no matter how high in academia a woman is, she's never going to excel as much as a man is.
All right,
and
Jessica.
Well, I think that's very interesting, Jessica. I mean, if you look at some of the top universities today, Princeton, Harvard, Brown, all these institutions have female presidents who climbed the old boy tenure track ladder and now sit atop the real kind of power centers in higher education. And they're just the tip of the iceberg. I think part of what's going on right now when we focus on that 77% number is that hides as much as it shows. And part of what it hides is the extraordinary door that really has opened to women over the last 20 years. Not to say that there aren't still lots of places for that door to open wider. And again, how that is affecting real change, rapid fire change in our society.
Here's a statistic from the Washington Post that I found interesting. About one-third of married mothers today leave the labor force to care for their children in any given year. Some outlets have reported an increasing trend in stay-at-home moms, among younger women especially. Do women have more choice because they can choose to stay home, Jessica, or less?
Well, I think everyone wants to be able to have the autonomy to choose. I think that women are waiting longer to have children now, and I think that my generation of young men is more open to the idea of sharing responsibilities and, you know, possibly being stay-at-home dads. So I think there's some progress there. But at the same time, you know, I don't have children yet, and I haven't had to make those decisions, and I know that they're difficult.
Caitlin Flanagan?
Listen, there's nothing, you know, this sounds like such a bromide. There is, in the course of human events, there's nothing more important than being a mother. I cannot think of anything that a head of a Fortune 500 company has ever done that would equal the work of a bunch of mothers. Because we, mothers are where the rubber hits the road. We are raising the children. We are taking care of one another. We are the shelter in the storm. And we have to grow up and say, there's a cost. You know, yes. If you are the head of a Fortune 5 country and you're a woman, you don't know your children very well. That's the bitter truth. There's a cost to this. And as soon as we accept that painful, unpalatable truth, then we start dealing in the realities of our situation and not what we want it to be. And that's hard. It's hard for all of us.
Let's go to Cordova, South Carolina. Stephen is on the line. Hi, Stephen. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I have a daughter who's actually very skilled in what she's doing. But one of the things, I've been listening, and I want to try to help her be a part of the culture change amongst women. You know, as business starts to grow, we start to accept who's doing what the jobs are. I've had to teach her to actually collect comments from her customers, to collect project information and say, here, this was done X time earlier. She's actually better at staying on task than I am, but she's not as good at collecting what I call her brag book. And I don't think at this point the women's movement has come yet to the point where they say, look back at what you've done. You know, collect yourself a brag book. How do you guys, and I'm listening to a very wide range of professionals, right? But how do women manage to change that part of it?
Stephen, thank you. We'll get to it. Nancy Kane.
That's a great comment, Stephen. I love the concept of a brag book. You know, I teach at the Harvard Business School, and I teach what, you know, we like to call millennials, young women and men. Our class is made up of about 43% women, and that number just keeps on rising. At the Harvard Law School, incidentally, there are now more women in the entering class than men. And these women coming of age now, Stephen, I don't know how old your daughter is, they are actually, I would say, very facile with one, technology, and two, very, very comfortable in a world in which making your way really does have to do with telling the world about what you've accomplished, as well as admitting or coming to terms with or trying to improve your weaknesses. So I think we're seeing a generational cut here that's quite important and that bodes well for the comment that you're making.
Nancy, we talked earlier before the program began about programs at the Harvard Business School of getting women back into the workforce when they're ready, after they've left. Many of them do MBAs from Harvard.
Absolutely. And we produce a large number of very talented, very well-educated women that go into the workforce right after their MBA, then step out of the paid workforce. They're still working, Caitlin. I couldn't agree with you more about they're doing the Lord's work, raising children and caring for aging parents. They're still working, but then they want to come back into the workforce, and to the point that both you and Jessica were making, they take a step backwards in most big companies. We at the Harvard Business School want to do something to help them make that transition. One of the fascinating things you see, both among young women that have not yet stepped out of the workforce and among women that have to have children, is you see women pursuing very entrepreneurial careers, starting their own businesses. There are over 3 million companies started in the United States every single year. The vast majority of those are formed by women, and those numbers are rising as women try and figure out how to build a full life that enables good pay, that enables self-fulfillment, that enables great service to themselves and their communities and their families, and do it outside the rule book and with a brag book, Stephen, of the past.
Here's Marilyn in Carthage, Tennessee. Hi, Marilyn. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I am a teacher, and I've been in the teaching profession for a number of years, and I've discovered that we truly are guardians of the culture. And I've always thought that we were the most underpaid group of women because of the kind of work we do. We prepare future lawyers and future doctors and future astronauts, and without what we do, there wouldn't be those careers or professions.
Marilyn, thank you. Jessica Bennett, writer for Newsweek, would you respond?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point, and we certainly undervalue women's work and undervalue teaching in this country. I also think that because we have a female-dominated industry of teachers, that young women who are going through school seem to believe they can do it all. And I think that there's a generational point to be made, that my generation of young women, we were post-Title IX. In some ways, we were very entitled. We thought we could accomplish anything. And in school, we did accomplish anything and everything that we could. And, you know, we didn't really learn about feminism, because who needs feminism when we're already equal? So we were very post-feminist in the truest sense. And then suddenly we entered the workforce and we realized, oh, wait, maybe we're not actually equal, and maybe we should have learned about feminism. And it's almost like the modern day click moment. So I think that young women are struggling with this in a way that the older generations didn't.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking this hour about the pay gap between men and women at work. The hit TV show Glee paid tribute to Equal Pay Day in this week's episode with a comment from the character Quinn, played by Diana Agron.
The fact is that women still earn 70 cents to every dollar that a man does for doing the same job. That attitude starts in high school.
You can join our conversation, listeners, this hour. Is there hope on the horizon for closing the wage gap? What changes do you see in policy and culture to even the playing field? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Nancy Kane is with me in the studio. She's an historian and professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School. Caitlin Flanagan joins us from California. She's a writer for The Atlantic. And Jessica Bennett is with us from New York City. She covers cultural issues for Newsweek magazine. Let's go right back to the phones. Barrington, Rhode Island. Anne is on the line. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I've long had this radical solution. I'd like to run it by people, and that is if each individual were only allowed to work 20 to 25 hours a week, one, there would be more jobs for more people because the same amount of work would still have to get done, and people could get more done when it came to helping the elderly, raising children, volunteering, pursuing hobbies that might on their own create second jobs. But if any given job was only topped off at 25 hours per week, we'd also be more equal with the wage tops of the rest of the world. And instead of our jobs going overseas, our jobs would stay here.
Sure sounds like an interesting interesting question, interesting solution. Anne, thanks so much for calling. Mary is now on the line from Boston. Hi, Mary. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
One of the things I would like to hear your guests address is the boom in women entrepreneurs and women starting their own business.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you know, I'm someone that started my own business about a dozen years ago because I saw what was likely to happen to me in terms of wage and position parity, and I wanted to get some control over my work life. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to hear your guests address that.
Mary, thank you. Nancy Kane spoke of that earlier before the break. Jessica Bennett, how do you see it from your reporting, women as entrepreneurs?
Well, I think that a lot of women have realized that it's hard to go into these industries, and so they're taking it upon themselves to be entrepreneurs and to start their own businesses. And Nancy could probably speak better to the specifics, but I think that there's a lot of hope out there, and I think that there's a lot of, you know, frustration, and people are channeling that into doing things on their own.
Absolutely. Jessica's, you know, hit it spot on. Women are starting their own businesses in record numbers. They have for many years, but for in record numbers now. And they turn out, with the data that we have, which is beginning to be thick and rich, to be very good entrepreneurs for some of the reasons we've talked about earlier in the program. Women are very good at problem solving. They're very good at multitasking. They're very good at managing people and making a little go a long way. They tend to be very good at finding the kind of confidence they need to lead, just the way a woman on a, you know, rainy road driving her kids doesn't give way to panic and doesn't tell her children she's nervous about the weather conditions because they're in the back seat. Women make very good entrepreneurs. And this is a very important development, not only for women and their possibilities, not only for families, but also for American society, because literally all new net job growth since 1980 in this country has come from startup companies.
Let's, to that point, here's Carl from our Facebook page. He says, last year I graduated from college and went to work full-time with a startup. I earned a sight over $3,000, most of that coming from independent contracting work with no benefits. A female in my graduating class earns $67,000 a year. We had comparable experiences in our fields. If my investment in time works out, I'll have pulled down somewhere between $10 million and $200 million in 5 years. She'll probably have made it up to $73,000. Nancy Kane, you just said women make good entrepreneurs. Carl asks here at the end, maybe guys take more risks.
You know, there's very good scientific evidence that, is kind of appealing as that is from a kind of stereotypical perspective, that it is not so. Women are, you know, manage risk, take risks, and deal with them as effectively, and in some cases, I was saying earlier, in the case of the trading floor, more effectively than men, as measured by returns. So I don't think that's an issue. I mean, Carl's talking about two very different situations, right? No cash and lots of equity, in the case of Carl, and lots of steady cash. Women that play the entrepreneurial game do very, very well. Just think about Oprah Winfrey, for example, who owns all her own company, is worth well over $1 billion.
Here's Vince on the line now from Boston. Hi, Vince. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm.
My point was really, I think it's more about the choices people make rather than their gender. I'm a single dad, And because of the choices that I've made, you know, I've been passed over maybe for promotions because I spend more time at home with my daughter. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, my priorities are kind of on my family or things of that sort. So I'm thinking maybe, you know, the points that were made earlier where it's really about women, maybe not so much. Maybe it's more about just the person and what they choose to do.
Vince, thank you. Caitlin Flanagan, it's about choices, not gender.
Yeah, it's totally about choices. And the thing is that far more women are doing what Vince is doing, which is to be the caretakers of children. And I just want to tell you a short little story, and I was wondering what Nancy would think of this. My husband works for a big Fortune 500. He works for Mattel. And they are the top, always they're rated as one of the most family-friendly companies, and their daycare is absolutely phenomenal. Here's something that happened a couple of years ago, or maybe 5 years, and I thought, this is it in a nutshell. They have this unbelievable daycare. Lots of executives put their kids in there. We didn't have our children in there, but he was with a group. There was a young woman who had her children there. It's perfect. Everyone, business school, study the Mattel daycare. It is perfect. So all these people were standing around looking at some plans for some work. And this one woman who was a phenomenal, I knew her, I know her now well, phenomenal young executive. She's wandering farther and farther away from the table where the plans are. And finally my husband kind of looked up, and she was all the way in the corner at the window, in this corner office, gazing out the window. And he said, "Sarah, what are you doing?" And she said very poignantly, "I can see Isabel from here." She didn't last another year. She did not last. The company did everything to keep her. But she had something in her heart that is such a deep woman thing that I don't think we want to get rid of. But boy, that's the paradox in a nutshell right there. That we, as Vince is, it's much rarer for a man, we connect to our children and we see our time with our children as being worth jeopardizing so much equity.
Absolutely.
I don't think there's ever an answer to that.
Nancy,
well, it's a very good point, Caitlin, and you're absolutely right. And it has to be kind of laid aside or laid beside the fact that most women that work outside the home and raise children are very, very happy doing that. Yes, and it presents enormous challenges, but they choose to go to work in addition to the myriad of challenges of running a home and really caring for your children well, raising them.
And
to
the
be-
price they pay is they're not there for those moments in their children's lives.
Well, you know,
the woman who works, you know what? They're not. I'm going to tell you the truth. When you're at work, you missed your child's first step. And you'll have that on you forever. I'm not saying that they're wrong to do that. My mom worked, and she profoundly changed my life to the positive. She missed a lot of things that really hurt her to miss. But if you are not there with your child, you're not the person who's seeing those moments.
And yet there are many women who must work, single moms who are out there.
Absolutely. And that's
no
the reality, the painful reality of this is that sometimes you have to work. Sometimes you want to work. Either way, you are missing out on the unrecoverable experience.
So I think, Caitlin, women see that issue quite differently. I think there's a spectrum of attitudes about what constitutes being there for your children, and it's a very important set of choices.
Right,
But there's also very good evidence, and especially this is very important right now, because remember that there are more women that are the major breadwinner, not just single women, women that are married whose husbands are unemployed or don't earn as much as mm-hmm. they do now. So the issue of how women view their role in and outside the home is actually become much more important right now.
Let's go to Mary.
Oh,
she's calling from Idaho Falls. Mary, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I was calling about the cost to our society of women in the workplace. And I was in college in the 70s and then earned a graduate degree from a major university and worked in industry for a short while mm-hmm. and then had my children in my early 30s and was able to stay home with them because of choices that my husband and I made to live on his salary. And what I have seen is during that time in the 70s, we were told as young women we could have it all. We could have wonderful children, a fulfilling career, a great marriage. And although that may be true for a minority of women, I think what I have seen over the last 30 years is that for most of us, we don't have the energy to do it all. And we have to make choices. And I really feel that it's been a great detriment to our society. We see so many problems with young people today. And I think a lot of that is because when their parents are out earning the good life and fulfilling themselves, There are a lot of children who were pretty much neglected, maybe not materially, but emotionally.
That's right. Mary, thank you. I'm going to jump in because we're running out of time here. But Jessica Bennett, do you see the same attitude in 20-somethings today of which Mary was speaking?
The idea of having it all? Well, I think that, you know, our feminist mothers thought that they could have it all. And I think that we have made a clear-eyed calculation that that is not always the case, and we do need to make choices. And much of the issue about women does have to do with choices. But to the earlier caller's point about how choices are accounting for the wage gap and the gender gap, I'd make the counterpoint that it's not just choices. And even really high-achieving women, women who go to business school and want to climb the corporate ladder and want to start their own businesses, a recent Catalyst study showed that even those women, recent graduates of MBA programs at the top-tier schools in the world, in their first jobs out of graduate school, they make $4,600 less than men. So, I mean, I sound a little bit like a broken record, but it's not just about choices. No. There is discrimination that still exists, and there is still sexism. And I think that you have to think about all of these different elements to when thinking about this issue.
Here's another call from Helen. She's in Alston, Massachusetts. Hi, Helen. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Jane. What an important program. Thanks so much for doing this. I'd like to make a comment and then a question.
Okay.
First, I just want to say that, you know, even to frame it as a choice, you think that one woman would want to choose to be underpaid. Women's work is never factored into the gross national product because it's always undervalued. And if you invite people to look at it as a choice, you disregard the gross inequity that's still inherent in the system. And this is where my question comes in. And I really love to hear from your people there about this. In higher leadership positions, women who reach those positions so often are acting like men. And so I have a hard time seeing that as progress, because if we don't get women's values and approaches into those positions where they're valued and acted on, and that the structure itself starts to change, then I can't call it a progress. And I'd love to hear your people respond to that.
Helen, thank you.
So,
Nancy Kane?
Very interesting question, Helen. So think about people like Andrea Young, who's the chairman of Avon, or, you know, Anne Mulcahy, who's the former CEO, now chairman of Xerox, or Indra Nooyi, who's the chairman and CEO of Pepsi. All those women are huge change agents. They're not, you know, in pinstripe suits and pants, right, trying to kind of outsports metaphor the boys around the table. They're women trying to change huge organizations. Remember, we are talking about an enormous shift in who has the chips. This doesn't happen overnight. And these women have made their companies different. So we don't want to undersell women. It's not for my students at the Harvard Business School today, nor for these CEOs, nor for women like Oprah Winfrey or Estee Lauder or some phenomenally successful women entrepreneurs. It's not about becoming more like a man. It really isn't. And we have to realize that women of our generation have raised a group of men that now, as Jessica just said, want to care for their kids.
Caitlin,
we have
Flanagan?
Major change afoot.
Jump in.
Well, I quote James Brown, it's a man's world, but it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl. You know, it's they still have the power, and I think they'll always have more of the power because our hearts are in something that a capitalist society will never value.
To Dutchess County, New York, Suzanne is on the line. Hi, Suzanne. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm just worried that I grew up, I went to college in the 60s, and I just saw, equal rights for women improving. And I knew my grandmother had not originally been able to vote and all that. I just thought it would get better gradually. It might take time, and there'd always be fluctuations. And then I started to look at the rest of the world, and I saw my daughter's generation not realizing, taking a lot of the equality for granted. And there's been tremendous good things. But I just feel as long as there's more men than women in power in Congress, as long as there's more men, that are CEOs or billionaires or whatever, I feel our rights are not safe, and I don't think that it would take, people would be shocked, but I think that it would not take too much to get things reversed.
Suzanne, thank you very much.
Maybe they're better at it than we are.
I'm going to jump in here because we have about 2 minutes late, Caitlin. Sorry, but the first bill that President Obama signed into law when he took office was the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which makes it easier for women to challenge inequitable pay. The president's also created a White House Council on Women and Girls, supports the Paycheck Fairness Act, which was passed in the House but now is languishing in the Senate. Is pay discrimination, which is what we're here today to discuss, an issue that should be and can be resolved by the government? Jessica Bennett?
Well, I think certainly some government intervention will help. I also think that a lot of what's facing women today in a corporate setting is culture, masculine, patriarchal corporate culture. And the World Economic Forum did a recent study looking at the biggest barrier to female success. And they said, no, it's not the wage gap. It's not motherhood. It's not having daycare programs. It's this culture that women have a hard time breaking into. It's this boys' club that still exists. And so I think while government support will certainly help, it's really a larger cultural issue that we all need to be talking about, and that's the first step.
Caitlin Flanagan, 10 seconds for your final word on that point.
I think that was well said.
Nancy Cohn.
Well, Hillary Clinton, Madeleine Albright, Nancy Pelosi, the game, even the big old boys game at Congress is changing slowly, steadily, but majorly.
Well, thank you very much for being here today. A discussion that jumped around to many different issues, but I appreciate your thoughts and your perspective. Nancy Cohn, historian, a professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, thank you so much. Great to have you.
Pleasure.
Jessica Bennett, senior writer for Newsweek. Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And Caitlin Flanagan, writer for The Atlantic. Caitlin, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Continue the conversation at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson. Tom Ashbrook will be back on Monday. This is On Point.